April 12, 1961, the Soviet Union's Yuri Gagarin becomes the first person to leave Earth and travel into space. But in the nearly half century since that day, only 500 others have taken that special voyage. Is that now about to change? Do problems here on Earth mean that we should start thinking about a new home in outer space? Tonight, live from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Plan B, are we bound for space?
Change.
Money spent on contraception is about 5 times more efficient than money spent on clean energy technologies.
Population growth.
We're pumping groundwater faster than nature naturally recharges it.
Resource depletion. Time to leave home.
Our only chance of long-term survival is not to remain inward-looking on planet Earth, but to spread out into space.
Or to fix up the place.
Ozone depletion at the pole is getting better.
Plan B.
Oh my goodness, it's beautiful up there.
Are we bound for space? Part one of the agenda at the Q2C Quantum to Cosmos Festival.
The Eagle has landed.
That's tonight on the agenda.
Hi again, everybody, and welcome back to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the Q2C Quantum to Cosmos Festival, featuring some of the sharpest minds in science anywhere in the world. Tonight, for us, the first of 5 special broadcasts on some of the most intriguing questions around science of this day. And if you couldn't make it down here for the festival, as this audience here obviously did, we've got several ways for you to be involved. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, is hosting a live chat on our Inside Agenda blog. We're streaming this broadcast, of course, and live blogging it at twitter.com/theagenda as well. If you want to participate that way, just go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, for details and much, much more, including a really terrific timeline of the major milestones in space travel that was put together by our very own David Irwin. And now to the main event. Given the problems here on Earth, is it time to colonize space? Or should we focus our energies on cleaning up the home we have now? To debate that this evening, Chris McKay, scientist with the NASA Ames Research Center. Chris Hadfield, astronaut with the Canadian Space Agency. Donna Shirley, former director at NASA's Mars Exploration Program. Carl Schroeder, science fiction writer and futurist. Lawrence Krauss, theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Institute at Arizona State University. And there's Bob Richards, CEO of Odyssey Moon Limited and the co-founder of the International Space University near Strasbourg, France. I want to thank all of you, some of whom have come from very long distances to be with us. You didn't exactly come from space, but you've been to space. More on that later. I want to start by reading something quite appropriate given the circumstances we're in tonight from Stephen Hawking, who had this to say: the long-term survival of the human race is at risk as long as it is confined to a single planet. Sooner or later, disasters such as an asteroid collision or a nuclear war could wipe us all out. But once we spread out into space and establish independent colonies, our future should be safe. Let me get all of you on that first. Lawrence, is he right?
Maybe. I think that it's true that we're putting all our eggs in one basket, literally the basket of the Earth, being here. And there will be at some point a catastrophe on Earth. So I do think our long-term future is in space. Whether our short-term future needs to be in space is a different question.
Chris Hadfield.
Absolutely. You're a poor student of history if you don't think that the Earth is naturally threatened by events that happen regularly, whether it's an asteroid impact. The world gets hit by 100 tons of meteorites every day, but sometimes there's a big one that really has a big impact, whether it's some sort of radiation effect that hits us from outer space, or whether it's just something that happens on the surface, a supervolcano or a change in the climate that occurs naturally, or something we do to ourselves. Absolutely, all our eggs are in this basket. And if we want to survive as a species, I think one of the ways to do that is to expand, put ourselves in at least two different baskets, use the technology we have, and continue to do what we've always done, expand.
Donna Shirley, we have to look out there?
Yes, I think we do. Whether or not we can colonize in anything, well, I think the idea that we can trash the Earth and then go into space and go to some other planet doesn't work. I mean, I think, yes, we want to explore, we want to eventually colonize, but we're going to be stuck with the Earth. There's just no way you can take 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 12 billion people and ship them off to Mars.
Chris McKay.
I disagree with that point of view. I think we have to take the point of view that when it comes to Earth, failure is not an option, to use the words from Apollo 13, which means we have to stop the asteroid impacts. We have to predict and control volcanisms and earthquakes and so on. Yes, go into space, but not because we're going to let Earth be destroyed or damaged. Save the Earth. I think that's an important point of view.
Carl Schroeder.
Well, who is this us that Professor Hawking is talking about? I don't want just the human race to survive. I would be incomplete if it weren't for the living things in the natural world around me. And I think all of us feel that way. I wouldn't want to live in a box for the rest of my life. I don't think anyone would want to, and I wouldn't want to travel to space if that were what it would mean. I think we have to, if we go to space, we, the planet, all the living things have to participate in some way.
Bob Richards.
Well, Stephen Hawking is right to point out that we're playing a numbers game. There's a pretty good chance that next Tuesday the human race will not be wiped out by a killer asteroid, but there's a chance it might be. And it's part of exploration is in this epoch of discovery. As we move out into space, we also take the biosphere with us. So it's not just we, the humans, but it's we, the planet Earth, that moves out into space because we have to take on the plants and the animals that we depend on to live. So it really is an expansion, not a departure, an abandonment of Earth, but it's an expansion of our civilization into other worlds.
Chris Hadfield, has the colonization angle on this always, in your view, been part of the whole need to explore space?
We already colonized space. People have been living permanently in space since the 70s, since the early Soviet space stations, then through Mir in the 80s and 90s, and now with the International Space Station. Right now, Expedition 21 is on the space station, the 21st continuous expedition. We have 6 people who have permanently left Earth, and we've left as a species. So we're already colonizing space. It's already happened.
That's in a very tiny way, though.
Sure, but that's how colonization happens. You don't launch all 10 billion people at once. You send an initial colony, and they figure out how to set up the beachhead. And the question is, how far and how fast? And I think the natural progression of what we've always done on the surface, as enabled by our technology, is what's going to continue to happen as we invent ways to get even further from the surface.
Carl, why go into space at all?
I don't think why is... Well, why would not be in a question at all if it were fantastically cheap to go into space? If it cost me $10 to go into orbit, no one would ask why. Mm-hmm. The only reason that people ask why is because it's expensive to get there. And I think the task for NASA and the other agencies right now is to make it so cheap that the question of why goes away.
Okay, the challenge is on. Chris, what do you say?
I think there is an answer to the question why, which is we want to find out what is the role that space will play in our future, our being humans and life. Are we going to go or are we going to stay? What are we going to do? I think it's an important question. And I think we don't know what the answer is. We have to learn that answer by going out and exploring. As to colonization, I would say initially, for 100 years or more, our exploration of space will be more like our exploration of the Antarctic. We'll be there continuously, but there won't be elementary schools. We won't be colonizing it. We'll be there as research scientists at research bases.
Lawrence, you want to take issue with that?
Yeah, well, I think that it's not even clear to me that in the long-term future, I think humans are pretty stupid things to send to space. They're big bags of water. We're not designed for space. I think we could probably colonize space very effectively with machines, and maybe ultimately in the long term, I think certainly the long-term colonization of space will probably be done by machines. Humans are meant to be on Earth, and I think the reason to send humans into space is because simply it inspires people. I've been on lots of panels with astronauts, and everyone loves astronauts, and because they've been in space. And when I was a kid, I stayed away from school to watch Apollo. It inspires people that we're boldly going where no one has gone before, I suppose. And I think that's the major aspect of it.
Is that a plug for your book again?
Yeah, I'm contractually obliged.
Constantly. The physics of Star Trek, for those who don't remember. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, even though I'm involved very heavily in robotic exploration right now, it's not a question of either or. It's a question of both and when and how. I think you'll find that the greatest innovation and the greatest evolutionary processes of humanity happened at the boundary conditions of a frontier, when the species first crawled out from the oceans onto the land, and now we're about to enter the oceans of space. So it's this boundary conditions under pressure where some of us who have this exploration gene that tries to be manifested in these exploration of discovery, it's together with machines and humans, but it's very important that we keep the human factor and a humanism as we move out into space.
Donna, why go into space?
Because it's cool.
Because it's...
It's neat. It's fun. Neat. I mean, you want to do that. I mean, haven't everybody in this room, if you're here, I bet everybody in this room has looked up and said, wow, I'd really like to go into space, or eventually my children could go into space or something like that. And they're all very jealous of this guy because he has gotten to go into space.
But there are a lot of things that are just as cool that are less expensive and less dangerous.
Well,
so why
as
would
a matter
we do
of fact, as a matter of fact, it's more expensive and more dangerous to go to Iraq.
Okay.
So I think that that you know the perspective is all wrong. People think we spend tons of money in space. We spend a minuscule amount of money in space compared to what we spend on pizza, and foreign wars and things like that. So I think the cost thing is completely misunderstood.
Lawrence.
It is right now, but I think if you're really talking about the kind of things that people are talking about, like going to Mars, then you have to realize that the amount of money is astronomical, excuse the pun. It's really so huge that it's not very realistic in current terms to think about a round-trip human mission to Mars. It's just so far beyond the amount of money we're spending right now that it's wonderful to talk about it, but it's not going to happen, I think, in the lifetime of many people in the world.
As long as you brought that up, let's go to this consideration right now, because the Obama administration has apparently got in place right now a review panel that is considering what we ought to do next, what they ought to do next. Norman Augustine, the former head of Lockheed Martin, is the chairman, and he has laid out, I gather, three potential paths. And here we are. Mars first, the moon first, or a flexible path, as it's called. And Bob Richards, I'm going to give you the next minute to sort of go through these three and tell us what they all mean.
Sure. Well, Mars first means that we bypass the moon, we just beeline it for Mars.
Earth to Mars.
Earth to Mars. We bypass everything else, and that really is the destination. And that's quite a large stepping stone to get over. The moon first is, of course, we go to the moon, we learn how to live on other worlds, we practice the stuff we need to do, and then we think about harder, longer, farther destinations like Mars. And then there's the flexible path, which says, well, it's really expensive not just to get off the surface of a planet, but to get back on. So the landing part is almost as expensive as the launching part. So the flexible path has us doing interesting things around the moon, but also near the asteroids and the moons of Mars without actually going down to the surface of planets.
Okay, those are the three options, and now I want to get you all to weigh in on what they ought to do. I'm going to start with you, Donna, and I think I know what you believe, given what you used to do.
Well, actually, I think that the flexible path probably makes more sense, given what Lawrence said about the money. And there's just so much we don't know about Mars, and we got our robots there, and they're exploring, and they're valiantly, Spirit and Opportunity are valiantly exploring, and we've got the MSL, if it's ever actually done, to go to Mars, and we've got lots of things in orbit, but Mars is a big, not understood place.
Wait a second, aren't you the former head of NASA's Mars Exploration Project?
Well, yes.
And you're going for flexibility as opposed to making a beeline right for Mars?
Well, because I don't want to do anything silly.
Okay. Chris, come on in. What do you think?
Well, imagine if when the Wright brothers or the Silver Dart was first flying, if they said, okay, we're not going to build an airplane until we can fly transatlantic. We would never have gotten anywhere. You have to take steps. You have to do all of the preparatory work. And it's not just the engineering work, but it's the public understanding of what you're doing. It is really hard with the technology we have right now to go to Mars. We could go. We've sent probes there. If we had an overarching reason to go, we could go with people very shortly.
Could you bring them back?
Potentially, but that's not necessarily the history of human exploration, of always coming back.
Right.
But if you look at how our main economies are driven, most of them are on a repetitive electoral cycle. We have funding cycles. We have to re-justify ourselves both politically and financially on a regular basis. And if you don't have any fruit from your tree for 15 years or 20 years, it's almost impossible to sustain the momentum to be able to accomplish what it is you set out to do. So I think you need a flexible path. You need to go for the first things that show that you're making progress and you learn the lessons, space station and the next thing that lies beyond it, moon, asteroids, and work our way further into the universe. That's what I think.
Carl?
All three options are terrible options. The reason is that...
Get off the fence. Tell me what you really think.
They're all predicated on one thing, and that is leaving the cost structure of getting into orbit the same as it is right now. They all assume that it remains just as expensive to get into space, and that we don't leave that issue alone. That is the issue that we need to solve. Make it cheap to get into space, cheaper by a factor of... 100, which we have to do, although it's damn near impossible to conceive of how at the moment. And all of a sudden, you don't have to have the choice of do we go to the moon, do we go to Mars? We will go everywhere.
Chris McKay, can you conceive of that kind of equation happening where once upon a time we paid hundreds of dollars for consumer gadgets that we now pay dozens of dollars for? Could the same math be applicable here?
It could, but I don't think that makes the question of where to go irrelevant. I think, in fact, it's the other way around. You decide you want to go somewhere, and then that momentum causes the development of technologies and competition that drives the cost down. And in terms of the choices, I speak for the moon. I think that ought to be our destination, because what we need to learn in space is not to boldly go. We know how to go. It's to stay. We need to learn to boldly stay where no one has stayed before. And the place we're going to learn to stay first is the moon. And once we've learned how to stay on the moon, then we can learn to stay on Mars. So we need a change of verb from go to stay. That's the key part, I think. And obviously, if we have that point of view, the drivers will push the cost down.
If you're playing along at home, 17 minutes to the first major Star Trek reference, although yours was a little earlier, now that I think of it. Okay, go ahead, Lawrence, pick up on it.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I agree with the moon. I mean, I once said that that's where we should go first, but the question is, what's the least boring thing? The most boring thing is the space station. I mean, the space station is really, forgive me, but it's really boring. It's
been
just,
there,
you
done
know,
that.
You could drive there in a car in 2 hours if you could just go up. And of course, it's from a scientific perspective, it's been kind of useless.
Let me interrupt.
I knew you'd jump on me here. But
you know, we're building the Perimeter Institute where we're sitting in here, and when you're building something, it's a pretty useless structure when it's only partially constructed. And also, I think there's a big common misperception between space exploration and space entertainment. The initial probes, where we prove we can go somewhere, that's fascinating. But you can only go somewhere for the first time once. Well, Apollo 12, Apollo 13, people were bored with going to the moon by Apollo 13, months after they'd walked on the moon. We can't entertain people. That's not a reason to explore space. And if you're looking for funding and public support because of space entertainment, you're doomed. Credible, long-term space exploration.
Let me jump back then to what I was going to get at, which is that I'm not sure what more we do then entertain in a sense, because the real science that NASA does, 99% of the science that NASA does, doesn't involve humans, really. I mean, why? Because when you send humans into space, you generally want to keep them alive, mm-hmm. and that takes most of the money. So if we're thinking about what we want to do, I think we have to think what's going to inspire people. And I ultimately think, in some sense, the moon is a lot less inspiring than Mars. And if we also really are interested in doing some science, there's much more interesting science to do on Mars than the moon. I don't really think there's much interesting science to... I mean, there's some interesting science, but Mars is a far richer place to do science.
You want to come back at that?
I think the Earth is a fascinating place to do science. even though we've been here for billions of years, we still don't really understand how it works. We don't know what causes ice age conclusively. We don't know what's very deep inside our Earth. We're just starting to understand the oceans, the ecosystem, we're just starting to put together. And we've been here with our scientists for thousands and thousands of years. It's still fascinating to say that the moon is boring when we've only been there a couple times and sent a few probes there. I think we've just started, we just plowed into the south end of the moon, and it didn't happen like we expected. So I think the moon has a lot of hidden secrets that we're just starting to understand.
Let's hear Donna, then Donna, then Bob.
The thing is that you don't have to send people to get people excited. I mean, people were very excited. My first Mars project that I actually did was the rover, Sojourner the rover. How many people liked that?
Let's get a shot of the audience. Hang on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The thing was the size of a microwave oven. It only went 100 meters. You know, it didn't do very much science, but everybody loved it. And it was very personable. And Spirit and Opportunity are very personable. Spirit is mired in the sand. Oh, my gosh. How are we going to? Let's free Spirit.
But does that speak
know?
To the point that that's more about entertainment than science?
No. I'm saying that there are science objectives, and the things are sent there for science. But it's entertaining science. You don't have to have people. And Chris will really disagree with me on this.
We'll
you
wait
don't
for
have
that.
To
Go ahead.
People.
Bob first.
I want to come to Shirley's point, too, because it's a great one. But on the false premise that it's men are machines, humans are machines, as well, it's a false premise of the moon or Mars. It's when and in what order. And, you know, if God wanted us to be space explorers, he would have given us a moon. And it's like the planetary archipelago. You don't send your kids to Algonquin Park for us Canadians to camp for the first time when they're 6 years old. You send them to the backyard. You learn how to do it. You have to make sure that, oh, we forgot our flashlights. We will learn a lot by exploring. We've only explored, what, 5% of the moon, maybe less?
Lawrence rolled his eyes a little bit when you were going on there, so I'm going to give
him
a shot.
Yeah, there are a few mentions there. But I think the bottom line is, what do we learn from sending humans into space? We learn how humans can live in space. So it is true that if we put people on the moon, it's a solid surface, and we'll learn how they can live on a solid surface. But I mean, I don't think we learn much more than that. So if we really want to learn about the moon, we don't want to send people there, I think, ultimately. If we want to learn how people can live on the moon, then we want to send people there. And that's we have to be honest about that question.
Okay, Chris.
Well, I want to hammer away at this notion that the reason we go into space is science, and that that is the metric, and we compare humans to machines on how well they do science. That's the wrong way to think about
exactly.
it. We are humans, and we live our life to fulfill our human experience and interest, and science is a tool we use. It's not something we serve. We don't go into space to do science. We use science to understand how we will relate to space and how it will fold into our human future. Humans are ultimately the only source of value and interest. Science is merely a tool. And this gets lost at NASA headquarters a lot. They start asking questions like, are humans the best tool to do science on Mars? And I go, wait, humans aren't tools. Humans are goals in themselves. Science is the tool. And I think that's something that we need to keep remembering. Why do we send in humans to space? Not to do science, but because we're humans, and that's part of what we do.
Let me pick up on Carl's point earlier about the financial angle on this. And Michael, let's bring this graphic up here. Space budget, international space budgets. Here's what we spent in the major countries in the world that are into space in the year 2008. This is in amounts in U.S. billions of dollars. There's Canada, $250 million. Russia, $1.54 million. The Chinese, a little more than that. The Japanese, about twice as much as that.
Billion.
The Europeans, right, billion.
Yep.
$4.25 billion. And look at the United States of America, $66+ billion annually on space exploration. Now, Chris, when you look at those numbers, what inferences do you have to draw?
Well, I'm puzzled because NASA's budget is about $17 billion a year, so I don't know where the 66, that must include
defense.
All of the Air Force, must all of the businesses, everything that's
must
involved.
Include defense.
It must include things like telecommunication satellites, all private industry, GPS satellites, research satellites, as well as human spaceflight. So it's a lot of money, but if I know the Canadian case better than I know the American case. $250 million compared to what Canada spends on the rest of its budget, what we spend on, I mean, Statistics Canada's budget is twice the budget of the Canadian Space Agency. Is that the right proportion? Probably. I think it's a reasonable percentage. How much of your money are you going to spend on space exploration? How much are you going to spend on day-to-day taking care of your people? You need to put it all into proportion. You need to see how much it's going to cost your country, what you're going
to
do.
But Chris McKay, it sure looks like the rest of the world is kind of counting on the United States to carry this ball, right?
Yeah, and it illustrates the point that for the United States, the space program is an instrument of national policy. The reason the United States has a space program is not because we have a dying interest in planetary science on Mars. It's because we want to have a leadership role in anything that's done on Earth with regards to space. We want to be first among equals. It's the political motivation for space science is what we do, but the long-term implications, I think, transcend both the science and these sort of narrow political interests that motivate the day-to-day budget.
Bob, what do you infer from those numbers?
Well, I think Chris is touching on a very important subject, and that's the international role that space plays. Space has a bit of a currency between nations. You'll notice in history that when nations sort of get in trouble, the one thing they can do that everybody can agree in is do something nice in space together. And there is an effort to go to Mars together. We'll go to the moon together. But it's this currency, this international currency in space that really can form part of the foreign policy that the U.S. uses very effectively.
Got a question here from the audience. Stand up if you would, sir. About spending, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm a little nervous.
Go ahead, me too.
Most budgets in space development countries, or countries that are involved in space development, are even less than 1% of their GDP. And we talk about all this expense and how going to space is important for the humanity of it, but the governments spend insignificant amounts to do this. And it comes to the point where I want to ask the question is, how do you motivate the big money? How do you get the big money into play here to go to Mars? It's going to cost a lot, but there's no will right now to spend that much. There's will to spend the money on lots of other things that cost trillions of dollars, but not space.
Let's find out.
How do you do it?
Lawrence, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say one thing. It is a small percentage of the total budget, but it's not that small. NASA's budget is much bigger than the budget of the National Science Foundation, for example. And so space is costly, and it will always be costly. And I think when people talk about bringing the amount of money down to go into space, I think the laws of physics tell us it's going to cost a lot. It costs exponentially more to go further into space. And if we want to get out to Mars, we're going to develop new propulsion mechanisms, but it's never going to be cheap. And I think we have to be honest about that.
Shooting fish in a barrel.
Go ahead, Chris McKay.
I have to disagree with Lawrence. The laws of physics are not what limits our ability to get into space. It's the laws of management and organizational behavior. If you imagine a spaceship and lay out all the hydrogen and oxygen and aluminum and metal and all the other materials, physical materials required to assemble that, the total cost, the total worth of that is trivial. It's the cost of the people to put it all together, certify it, and launch it. It's a management challenge, not a law of physics problem. And those challenges lend themselves to cost reduction. So I think the answer to the question, should we spend more, should we bring in the big money, is no. We should be smarter with the money we have. For $17 billion, we ought to be able to have a base on the moon and a base on Mars.
Yeah. Carl?
Well, you want a motivation for going into space. I'll give you a motivation. We're currently using 3 Earths worth of resources, meaning the water we use, the air we use, the minerals that we mine, the energy, and most importantly, the ecosystem services, the things that we get from the plants and animals that we live with on the planet. We're using 3 times as much as the Earth can sustain of that. What we have to do is we have to learn how to get by using less of the resources of Earth's ecosystem. There's only one good way to do that, and that's find somewhere that has no ecosystem services where you can learn how to get by without them. That is the moon. That is Mars.
Well, that's the Gobi Desert as well. Why don't you go there?
No, the Gobi Desert is full of ecosystem services. It's got air. It's got a little bit of water. It's got life. It's got access to other places. We have to learn to live as if we were living on the moon here.
Okay, question here.
Sure. In the past, the United States government has done the most work in terms of getting human beings out into space. How do you see the relationship between the U.S. government and NASA with international partners and also with the private sector?
Donna, why don't you start on that?
Well, the space station is a really good example. And one of the things when they talk about canning, you know, getting rid of the space station in 2016, I consider that to be insane. I mean, what would Canada say if they spent all this money developing the Canada arm and all that sort of stuff, and then we dunk the whole thing in the ocean, not to mention the Europeans and the Japanese and the Russians and so on. So I think that one of the big benefits of the space station and of any major human exploration project, and even the robotic ones, I mean, Mars is surrounded by international rovers and orbiters and things like that. So space is sort of inherently a United Nations endeavor.
Bob.
Well, the question touched on one of my favorite subjects, and that's what is the private sector role in space exploration, and why isn't it there? If you look throughout history, there are very few cases where the private sector, commercial interest, haven't entered a marketplace and drastically reduced the cost of that technology. If you look at the international aviation industry or the merit or boats, anything that the government has only stayed in to fund stays very expensive. So it's the partnership of the private sector with government that will be transformative to space in the future, and that's going to help bring the cost down. Lawrence?
Well, you know, it's nice for Chris and you to say that, you know, you could bring the cost down, you should bring management down. If we look at the history of it, it's always cost a lot. And when I think about 2001, A Space Odyssey, I was just watching it again, and we were all supposed to be in hotels in space because there's going to be profit to be made. The point is, I think if you look at the amount of money that needs to be invested, especially in long-term exploration of space, not just going into low Earth orbit, it's so great that the return, I think, is so slow that it's hard to imagine private industry alone being willing to spend that kind of money, because the return is so far down the line that I can't imagine that we're going to have those kind of projects without the government being involved.
Bob, well, come back.
I did say a partnership. Let's put the cost thing in perspective. Okay, from the plug energy of what it takes to get a person into space, you can do the calculation. Any student in the audience can. It's the potential energy times the kinetic energy of the orbit. If you plugged it in and paid the per plug kilowatt hour, it's about $100. It cost about $100 million to send somebody up, arguably, on the space shuttle. There's a million-to-one price performance curve that can be challenged by technology, and that's what's going to bring the cost down.
Well, okay. there's another factor, which is that we're rushing things. Look how long it took us to actually settle Canada. I mean, we had the first explorers. We had the first, you know, Vikings landed in 1,000 or so. The Indians and the Native Americans, whatever they are called, the Inuit and so on, were here for a long time. But before you really had major settlement equivalent to a Mars colony or even a lunar colony, it was hundreds of years. So I think, you know, people are trying to push the envelope a bit.
Chris Hadfield.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think it's a natural process that we go through. I tend to look back in history as well. All of the great explorers have had a miserable time getting funding. They've had to go to international consortia to get their funding to be able to do it. Everyone always says, we got so many problems here at home. Why would we go do that? Europe knew about the North American continent for generations before several of the countries even sent their first probes across. Generations, multiples of years went by before some of the countries that knew this huge untapped resource, this enormous area of development was there, and it took a long time, just Donna said, for them to even start to go have a look and send their first probes. We all kind of want instant gratification. We want to go to space right now. We want to bring it right in immediately, and we have to invent some things. We have to bring it into the human perspective as well. We have to understand our place beyond the realm of our own neighborhood or our country and include what lies beyond. It takes time.
Okay, speaking of time, we're a little more than halfway through the program, so let me do a little business with the folks at home for a second. I want to remind everybody where we are and what we're doing tonight. We're at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. This is the first of five parts we're doing every night live this week on TVO here in Waterloo, Ontario. We're here as part of the Quantum to Cosmos Festival, a worldwide gathering of some of the sharpest minds in science. If you were not able to be with us tonight, if you're watching at home or on your computer, dial us up at tvo.org/theagenda. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, is standing by there, willing to go through the travails of a live chat with you. And while you are there, be sure to check out our interactive timeline, major milestones of space exploration that Dave Irwin put together for us. That and complete festival coverage, live streamed, video on demand, it's all at our website, tvo.org/theagenda. So check that out. Now, Chris, I want to come back to you one more time. You have explored space, but I want to know if you would be prepared to colonize/live in space.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what I trained for the last year and a half. When I was backing up Bob Thirsk, who's on the space station, was to go and live in space for 6 months. There's been several places on Earth I've lived for less than 6 months.
But I mean in a more permanent basis. Would you be prepared to go live in space for 10 years?
Sure. I've lived in a lot of different places around the world, and it really depends on what is your motivation for going. What is it you see in your life? Why are you doing this thing? Why do you not all just stay in your hometown for your entire life? Do you think, as a person or as a society, that this is something that should become part of the human experience? Should we build the structure? Should we build the railroad? Should we build the airports? Should we build the power lines? The equivalent of that, so that now our artists and our poets and our philosophers can go up and experience what it looks like to see the world and bring that back to all the other people. And I think, yes.
Chris McKay, in which case, paint the picture for us. If we were going to colonize, for example, the moon or Mars, how would we do it?
I think when we use the word colony, it's not correct. I would imagine that a base on the moon or a base on Mars will be more like the bases we now have in Antarctica. For example, South Pole Station has been operating for 50 years continuously. People have been there 50 years, but there's no elementary schools, there's nobody living there in a permanent basis. I've been working in Antarctica for 25 years, back and forth, back and forth. I think that's the way we'll do the moon and Mars. So I think colonies isn't the right word. Permanent research bases is the words I would use.
Lawrence, what would you say?
Well, I recently wrote a piece arguing that the way to go to Mars is one way, that we should send astronauts one way, forgive me, Chris, but actually, in fact, found that most astronauts are willing to do it. Not only would you save a tremendous amount of money, but if you actually think of this history of colonization, people have been prepared in the long-term history of exploration to not return. And I think that if we're going to think of wild and expensive things like sending people into space, we have to think of going outside the box. And I've been amazed. In fact, Buzz Aldrin was calling me nonstop after I wrote that piece, because wanting to go to Mars and stay there.
Let me get the follow-up from Chris Hadfield. Do you think astronauts would be prepared to go into space knowing that it was a one-way trip?
It's the other way around. I think there are countless numbers of people on Earth that are willing to do that. They have in the past. Yeah. So many people loaded their whole families, cows, luggage, and went to Australia. 6 or 7 month voyage, and they weren't coming back. And anybody who signed up to do that to space, by definition, would be an astronaut. So I think humanity has proven countless times in the past, yes, we're ready to do it. And so I think astronauts would do that in the future if that's what we chose.
Question back here, please.
Thank you. Speaking of long-term staying in space, my question regards resources. It brings to mind the biodome, having a closed system on Earth. That didn't really work out too well. I'm just wondering what happens when you run out of oxygen. Do we take it from Earth and bring it to the moon? Is it plausible?
Who wants in on that one? Go ahead, Carl.
That's the very reason to go up there, to get it to work once and for all. And again, coming back to what I mentioned about having 3 Earths worth of resources that we're using up, the fact is that we're screwing up the biodome that we live in right now, and we only have one to play with right now. So we only have one shot right now at learning, how to manage the systems that we live with.
Since you're on this, Carl, this is a good spot for me, if I can here, to bring in an excerpt from New Scientist magazine from earlier this year. Here's a scenario. Alligators basking off the English coast, a vast Brazilian desert, the mythological lost cities of Saigon, New Orleans, Venice, and Mumbai, and 90% of humanity vanished. Welcome to the world warmed by just 4 degrees Celsius. There is another option, to look down from space here and fix the problems on planet Earth. Do we have enough time to do that? Carl?
Probably not. but we should try. I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I owe it to her to try. And I think we all have that obligation. And we have most of the solutions technically. In fact, I think we have all of the solutions technologically. What we lack are political solutions right now. Global warming is not a technical problem. Global warming is a political problem. But one of the solutions to it is, one of the technical solutions is access to space.
Lawrence, I saw your lecture earlier today, and you say humans are insignificant and the future looks lousy. So I think I know where you're coming from on this.
Well, no, I think what you're alluding to is a problem that's happened a lot, that somehow by not going into space, we're going to solve those problems. It's the same argument that led to canceling the superconducting supercollider in the United States. When you cancel these science projects, it's not as if it's a zero-sum game. It's not as if by not going to Mars, you're suddenly going to deal with these problems. As you're pointing out, it's political issues. It's the political will and the amount of money that we're spending in Iraq and other places are huge by comparison. You're not going to, those problems are of vital importance and we need to address them, but you're not going to solve them by not going into space or by not doing forefront science research. It's just not an either or situation. Bob.
One of the ironies of the space programs in the 1960s is the images of Earth floating in space is what gave rise to the ecological movements and the sense of limits to growth and everything else. It's absolutely obvious we have to be good stewards and custodians of our home planet. It only makes sense. Even the lowest animals know not to defecate in their own nest. But the limitless energy and resources available in space can also have the opportunity of raising every standard of living here on Earth. So we need to be able to embrace those as well and do it in a proper way while balancing our concerns on Earth with our exploration of space.
Chris McKay, we got enough time to fix this?
I want to agree with what people are saying. Leaving the Earth is part of understanding the Earth. And that's our foremost job right now, is to understand the Earth. And part of that job will be leaving the Earth and looking at it from above and looking at other worlds that may have had biological histories and may also have biological futures, worlds like Mars.
And the space station is boring, but it's the ultimate biodome. We are now figuring out, as a planet, as a species, how it is we can separate ourselves from the mother planet, live in a completely closed ecological system, and figure out how to survive. That's what we're learning on Space Station. How to, for the very first time in the last 6 months, we have a closed water cycle. We can recycle our water on board. And it doesn't work right away. And you got to figure it out. You got to try a whole bunch of different ideas. And we're figuring it out. We're getting better and better at it. If we're going to go further, we got to solve those problems.
And learning how to fix the toilet.
How to fix the toilets. We need it.
Up till now, it hasn't been a closed system. We've been supplying it. But
I agree.
But do you agree that the real purpose of the space station then is just to figure out how? I mean, it doesn't do anything else except figure out how people can live up there, not die.
No, of course I don't agree with that. We've just got it up and running. We just got six crew up there. We've just attached the two big laboratories in the last year and a half. That'd be like saying, this institute right here, we already got half the building built. How come you guys haven't invented something wonderful yet? You have to give laboratories time, and you have to give people the opportunity to overcome all the difficulties. We're just in the stage of that right now.
Okay, friends, back of the hall here.
We're always talking about the economic impacts on our lives, but I think for one second we should probably think about what are the societal impacts. Like, for instance, you know, we're talking about, you know, national GDP for space programs like 1 or 2%. What if that 2% more was put on trying to fix our world's problem first before trying to screw up another planet's system?
Donna, how about that?
I couldn't hear what he said.
Unfortunately. Okay.
The issue is, if we're spending 2% of our GDP, for example, on space, what if we took that and tried to put it towards solving the problems here on Earth rather than, I think your words were, screwing up another world first?
Oh, it would be great, except that you'd have to figure out politically how to divide up that 2% of the GDP, which is the really big problem. You know, every country, every state, every province would want to have their share. It makes it very difficult to do anything, and it's as Chris said, it's the political issues that keep us from getting there. I worked on the very early version of the space station. We could have had a much simpler space station up and working much earlier, but it wasn't expensive enough.
Chris Hadfield, do you hate those arguments which say, boy, if only we took that money we were blowing on space and spent it on, you know, alleviating poverty here on Earth?
Well, it's mostly a question of a misunderstanding of what things actually cost. How much does Canada spend on health and welfare, of taking care of the Canadians on a day-to-day basis, and how much do we actually spend on the space program and on the human space program? And for every $1,000, I got the government's figures from last year's budget, for every $1,000 the Canadian federal government spends, we spend $230 on health and welfare, and we spend, I think, 4 cents on the astronaut program. So if we completely canceled the opportunity for Canadians to be astronauts so that every Canadian kid who was ever inspired to explore space had to leave our country, become a citizen of another country, it would give us 4 cents out of every thousand to add to the already $210 that we're spending on health and welfare. It's a drop in the bucket. I think it's a pretty good balance. And I get to speak at schools all across the country and look at the inspiration in the eyes of kids who see, I can do something marvelous. I can do something with my life in my country that nobody's ever done before. How do you give kids that challenge and that opportunity if your government doesn't take some percentage of the money and spend it on the future?
Back here, please.
This question's for the entire panel, or anyone on the panel would like to answer. What would you tell to the next generation, or my generation, Generation Y, who want to be the next space explorers and permanent research base inhabitants?
Well, we got to go to the guy who's been up there. Go ahead, Chris Hadfield, you start, then we'll go around.
Just repeat the question, if you would, please. Yeah.
Sure. What would you like to say to the youth of my generation, Generation Y, who want to be the next space explorers and permanent research base inhabitants?
I've wanted to be an astronaut since I saw the very first space explorers and the first people go to the moon. I think people forget that we live on this little spaceship and everything else is out in space. Everything else. There's an unlimited number of opportunities out there, and the only thing that is stopping us is our imagination, our ability to figure out better engines, make them cheaper, get there faster, make it easier, how to build a spaceship, a place on the moon that we can tend, and maybe eventually babies will be born there. People will stay there permanently. That will become part of the human experience. And people get so closed in on their day-to-day fascination with the problems that are coming through the television. I think you need to look long-term and look at the rest of the universe, and for the first time we have access to it as people. I think that's the fundamental inspiration.
Let me do a bit of that right now, Chris Hadfield, because I think a lot of our discussion so far has focused on the notion that it will be the governments of this world that lead the way. And Bob, I'm going to want your opinion first and foremost on this. Michael Smith, can we see the public versus private money being spent? Here was the global space economy in 2008, $257+ billion U.S. dollars spent, and who was spending it? Overwhelmingly, two-thirds of it came from private sources, one-third from government sources. Bob, if governments apparently are not paying the lion's share of the shot, can the private sector lead the colonization of space, in your view?
Well, those numbers seem to contradict the graph you showed earlier where the enormous amount of money spent by the U.S. government was skyrocketing. Well, in fact, those numbers
I don't think they contradict for what it's worth. It's just this is how it breaks down.
No, sure. But what the numbers do include is communication satellites. They include where the money is. And there are $170 billion worth of economic value flows through geosynchronous orbit every year. This is the realm of commercial space activity right now. It's just in Earth orbit.
What would be in it for a company like yours?
Oh, well, for Odyssey Moon, we're kind of a FedEx to the moon. So we're trying to come up with a transportation system to send not just information, but goods and services to the surface of the moon. So if we can expand Earth's economic sphere to the surface of the moon and beyond, create economic dipoles between worlds, companies like mine, like Odyssey Moon and others, will be able to partner with governments and build that railroad so we can lessen the cost. And what we get in return is we get economic return on our investment and on R&D, and we become the first explorers, the companies that help enable the markets that will arise as a result of the cheaper transportation.
Just briefly, do you think there's a future in tourism to the moon?
Eventually. I don't like the word tourism, though, because anybody goes through what Guy Laliberté just went through to go up into the space station, they are private space explorers. They go through the same training, and Chris will tell you. A tourist is somebody who sits in a bus and somebody in the front says, look left, look right, right? We're not there yet. It's going to be a long time.
Lawrence, then Donna.
Well, I think regarding that, we have to remember that not only is space exploration expensive, it's also dangerous. One of the reasons we're so enamored by people like Chris is that they're risking their lives. And they know they're risking their lives, and they're willing to do it. And we've already learned from the space shuttle, which was supposed to be, you know, everyday space transportation, that 2% of the time you're going to die. And I think we have to realize that it's going to be dangerous. It's going to be very hard, I think, in this litigious society to imagine how it's going to be easy to send people to their death easily. And it's always going to be, I think, well, for the near term, it's going to be people who are willing to risk their lives who are going to do it.
Donna.
Well, let me talk about Mount Everest. people are paying $65,000, $70,000, I don't know how much it is now, to be guided up Mount Everest with higher than a 2% chance of dying, and they're doing it for fun. The other thing is that the money-making in space, first was telecommunications, second is going to be Earth observations. And Earth observations is starting to have a payback. And the moon thing is pretty far out there, but there's some stuff that is actually going to make money right now besides telecommunications, and you're going to see that wedge grow with the commercial part.
Carl, quick word on this?
Be unmanned, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Carl,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the other aspect here is that hitherto, the enabling technology for getting into space, i.e. really big chemical rockets, has been just too expensive for private companies to get into. And chemical rockets are the limiting factor for access to space. As long as we use chemical rockets, it's going to be mind-bogglingly expensive. There will be no such thing as space colonization.
Okay.
But there are new technologies coming along that have lower cost of entry that the private sector could potentially use to get small parcels in large volumes into orbit, like laser launch.
Okay, got a few minutes left, and I want to tackle two more things. Chris McKay, we got this online from a teacher who is asking this on behalf of her class. When it comes to the search for extraterrestrial life on Mars, what advantage do you think human explorers would have over robotic?
The main advantage that human explorers would bring to searching for life is the ability to look at a sample and decide what to do next based on what's there, and the flexibility that the human hand and brain and eye bring to the sample analysis and procedure. So we could achieve in a few months with humans what would take decades and decades with robotic explorers. So if you want to know the answer fast, send people.
Lawrence.
I disagree with Chris, because the point is, it may take decades and decades with robotics, but it's going to take decades and decades to get humans to Mars. In that time, you know, we could send the rover to Mars for what it takes to make a movie about going to Mars. And we could send 500 rovers to Mars.
We've already done
and
that.
In 20 years, I expect robots are going to be much better than, forgive me, Chris, at looking at the surface. So I think the argument in the long term for not sending humans is not so clear. 50 years, I bet robots will be a lot cheaper and they'll be a lot better than humans.
Carl, tell me this. What would it mean to our species for us to think that Earth is no longer our only home?
Well, there's a lot of answers to that. It could have religious implications. I hope that it would not mean that we could say, hey, we trashed our garden, let's move over and take over the neighbor's garden. One of the most inspiring and important aspects of the famous Earthrise photograph taken by one of the Apollo orbiters as it was going around the moon.
Taken by a person, that was right.
Yes, yes, it was taken by a person. Is that it showed the Earth as a whole. And for the first time in history, we had, you know, a global concept that we were all in one basket, as it were. And I think that moment that you're talking about has already happened. I think that was the moment.
Got 40 seconds left. Chris Hadfield, why don't you tackle that? What would that mean to our species?
I think it would continue to expand our understanding of ourselves, of where we came from, of how precious the Earth is. I've walked in space, held on to the outside of a spaceship and looked at our planet against the blackness that goes on forever. And you really understand just how special and wonderful this planet is. Imagine if we had people permanently on the moon, learning about that planet, also looking back at the Earth, moving out, understanding the Earth's place, the moon's place, Mars' place, and thus our place in the universe. I think it's a natural expansion. I think it'll only make us greater.
One of only 500 people who've done that, who've been in space, and he gets the last word today. Can I thank all six of our guests for coming from near and far to participate in tonight's discussion? We're really grateful. I want to thank this audience for taking time out of their schedules to come and participate as well and to watch our program. And let me just close by saying, for more information about tonight's guests, Stephen Hawking's interview about the future of humanity on Earth, our interactive timeline of space exploration, rather, got the World Series on my mind, and complete Q2C festival coverage, please visit us on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Tonight's program was produced by Sandra Jonas. Thanks a lot, Sandra. And you can read Donna Shirley's Martian reading list. You can find that online on our Inside Agenda blog at tvo.org/theagenda. Stay with us, please. We're going to be right back with a programming note about tomorrow right after this.
sure, quantum mechanics is weird. This way of thinking about the world, of understanding it at the level of quantum information, has the potential to transform every technology that we possess. And by transforming it and by learning to talk with these atoms and elementary particles, we'll find a new place for ourselves in the quantum world.
Real physicists do it at a quantum level. The Quantum Tamers, tomorrow at 10 on TVO.
For 10 days in October, Waterloo will be the center of the scientific universe. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival will bring the world's brightest minds together to discuss everything from quarks to black holes. TVO is proud to be the official broadcaster of the event. The agenda will come to you live from the Perimeter Institute during the week of October 19th through 23rd. Our guests will be world-renowned leaders in their fields, giving us great insight into some of the foremost science-related questions of the day. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival on the agenda. Plan on being a part of it, October 19th through 23rd at 8 p.m.
Funding for the agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Valley Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And just before we close it off tonight, I'm advised by Mike Miner, who's our fifth column blogger, who has been conducting the online chat tonight, that we've had double the number of people in our chat room having a conversation about tonight's program, about space exploration, about space colonization. So, Mike, good job to you too, and thanks to all of those of you who participated online in that way on our first program here at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo. And we're here for another four nights, folks, so we hope you're not going anywhere. That is the agenda for Monday, October 19th, 2009. Tomorrow night, part two, as we said, of the agenda at the Quantum to Cosmos Festival. We're calling tomorrow night's program Wired 24/7. If you think technology rules your life right now, as Al Jolson used to say, you ain't seen nothing yet. For complete coverage of the Q2C Festival, including live streaming video, our Ask a Scientist segments, our blogs, visit us online at tvo.org/theagenda and click on the Q2C link. And one more thing just before we go tonight, a reminder that we're going to be launching our 10th season, 10 years, at the Monk Center for International Studies on the downtown campus of the University of Toronto. We'll be there next Thursday, October 29th, with a program dedicated to the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Has enough time passed for us to digest the lessons of communism's failure? That's what our topic is going to be next Thursday, and as usual, space is limited at the Monk Center, so be sure to get your tickets by going online to tvo.org/theagenda and clicking on the Monk Center link. Hope you can join us for that. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we'll see you again tomorrow night live from the Perimeter Center for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. Night, everyone.